In developing maturity, there are a lot of problems coming in on us today, and they're almost like time bombs. They're like time bombs going off all around us. They're set to go off at certain times. It's like putting a splinter in a person's foot, and then a few days later, he's going to really hurt. There are a lot of splinters stuck in people that later on in life, they're going to really fester up and give some problems. And they're like time bombs exploding all around. They don't wipe you out. You don't get killed with it. You just get shaken up. And you just, the whole body just shakes, and your psyche shakes, and everything else shakes. They're just exploding all around us, time bombs. I want to give you a feel for what I'm talking about in the time bombs in this first point of detonation of time bombs, because I think these time bombs are exploding in such a way that they are the greatest detriment to moving on to maturity that we have today, because they're causing some real difficulty in our own psychological makeup. And there are three types of time bombs. There's what I would call the physical time bombs, the social time bombs, the spiritual time bombs, and these are causing all kinds of problems emotionally for people out there. In the physical realm, there is the chemical time bomb. The chemical time bomb is in all kinds of, has a couple of classifications. One would be the chemicals that we're using on crops and how that we're just really killing the soil. We're also maybe killing some people in the process by what we're eating. We're not eating pure vegetables anymore. They're all shot up with all kinds of chemicals. We've got the chemical craze and the anti-vitamin or the vitamin anti-chemical. You got to have something that's natural because everything else is chemical, and all the sugar and the fight against sugar and the white flour and all this. There's such a rage today on this chemical time bomb. There are chemicals that are killing our cattle and killing all kinds of stock, livestock, because of something that we sprayed on the crops. It's just an endless cycle of chemicals, and we're in a chemical society where all these chemicals are shot in. We have another phase of the chemical, and that is the pills that everybody seems to be on, and this pill and that tranquilizer and this upper, this downer, and just the chemical craze. And yet I think it's a time bomb because it's dealing a lot with symptoms, and in a lot of ways it's out of control. And no one really has come along and said, this is the answer, here's what we got to do. And even if somebody did come along and say that, they'd just be one voice in a wilderness, and no one else, it couldn't control the whole deal. The second physical time bomb is ecological, and this follows suit with the chemical, the ecological time bomb. We're having difficulty, of course, right now. This is very contemporary because of the water shortage out here, with the climate getting much colder in the farming areas of our country and what they've just gone through there. We're coming through with some very difficult crises right now ecologically. We're having some very difficult times pollution-wise, even though we've got a lot of controls, and the rest of the world doesn't have the controls that we would have in a lot of ways. Pollution is getting to be a very desperate thing. It seems like there's an oil spill every day. For some reason, we've had a little barrage of that. But it's out of balance. It's out of control. No one knows exactly how to put the thing back together. And one thing you get corrected, it starts another one. And then you get that corrected, it starts another one. You add to this the whole area of the earthquake problem, the storms, all of the things that are happening. There are a lot of books coming out right now by scientists on climatology and how the climate is changing so much. I just read a book not long ago that said that the climate is changing so much that the only farming belt in the world will be someplace like from Minnesota down to Texas, and that'll be it. Well, with these kinds of voices screaming out at us and talking in those physical time bombs, it begins to cause a feeling of like we're in a terminal generation or something. It's like that there isn't any more, or what's going to happen? Add to this the population explosion, and what's happening on that is absolutely incredible worldwide. And the starvation that goes along with it right now. People starving throughout the world. It's hard to believe that sitting where we sit in the best place in all the world, but people are starving. Every few seconds, somebody's dying because they're starving. Physical time bombs. And it's going to begin to affect us even more, and yet there's the fear that that kind of thing is going to cave in on us somewhere. It's out of control. Then there are the spiritual time bombs. The spiritual time bombs, there's one more here. Biological. Good night, this is one of the biggies. Biological time bomb. The biological time bomb is very interesting because now they're saying through the test tube babies and all the incredible things they can do through this biological scene and all of the biological sciences and all the sciences, what they're doing now is absolutely incredible. And now they're saying we can create life, we can put it in a test tube, and then we can put the kind of person together we really want to put together so he doesn't have any hang-ups. And what's happening in that field, there's quite a committee now headed by, I think, Senator Kennedy, where they're talking about bioethics. Bioethics. They're scared to death. No one really knows where to draw the line. We've opened up the door of abortion. The next thing is euthanasia. And where's it go? But you see, if man is only an animal, or if man is just a machine, it doesn't make any difference anyway, does it? Biological time bomb is an indication of what's going on in the sciences of great things, but at the same time, very frightening things are taking place out there. Frightening. And we hear it. And we take it in. And it's like a time bomb shaking the system. The spiritual time bombs, the first one is psychological time bomb. Psychological time bomb. The psychological time bomb is very interesting. The psychological time bomb is full of self-help groups and people who say if you do this, you'll be better off, and if you do that, you'll be better off. And everybody's doing their thing, and some things are really a lot better off. But basically, the views of man are very, very different from the psychological time bomb. A lot of people believe that we've got to get out and do our own thing. And more psychologists are pushing this, go do your own thing, go do your own thing. As many attorneys have said to me, I can't send people to go get counseling for marital counseling because they don't get marital counseling. They get told, go do your own thing and split. Well, certainly some people have problems that are such and are such great degree that they are going to go ahead and split. And there's no sense trying to put something together that they are determined that's not going to work. But it's because there's no game plan. No one is able to step forth and say there's a game plan out here that works because there's a base to it. But there is no base, so you do your own thing. And we keep telling people to do their own thing. That doesn't work if everybody did it, of course. But on a limited scale, keep doing your own thing. We've got all kinds of things that are trying to help us deal with the stress. If you saw the documentary yesterday on stress, by some company, I forget, some insurance company puts it out, but it was on television, and it was an interesting documentary on 90% of our problems caused by stress and this kind of thing. And they have all kinds of methods. One is to light a candle in the church, and that's going to help you. Another, or light a lot of candles. Another one is, of course, TM has been a very popular one. In Psychology Today, it's interesting how what stand they've taken on TM. They said if you sit down for 20 minutes in the morning and sit down for 20 minutes at night and don't think about anything else, you'd be better off too. So, I mean, who knows what's going on out there? The psychological time bomb. Not a whole lot of answers, but a whole lot of doing your own thing. The next time bomb is what I would call the parapsychological time bomb. And this is really a frightening thing. Parapsychology today is becoming more of a technical term. I'm using it more generally. Parapsychology is appealing to, in the technical sense, is appealing to the sixth sense, mental telepathy, ESP, this type of thing. And that is not nearly as much of a time bomb as the parapsychological in the general sense, and that is appealing to the spirit world, through all kinds of mediums, whether it be people or Ouija board, this type of thing. And people are seriously doing it. I mean, this isn't just a game anymore. It's very serious. Very serious. And real things are happening. And of course, as you go and watch The Exorcist, if you're brave enough, or if you read it, you began to get a feel of a real documented case of what was happening there. All that started with a Ouija board. That's not saying that all Ouija boards are going to do something bad to you, but it's saying that maybe there is some kind of spirit world out there that's doing something. I just had a call this last week from Huntington, West Virginia, where a girl was in a Satan worship meeting. She'd been in a Satan worship cult for quite some time. She got out of that a year and a half ago, and she was just abducted last week by this group. They cut her up pretty badly on her arms and her head and tried to use some kind of a ceremonial type of deal with her and tried to get her to come back into the Satan deal. They have some kind of incredible power that they are coming at someplace. It's not something they got psyched up on, but they're doing some very interesting things. They dumped her out in the street in front of their house. They threatened other people. I mean, these people are not just psychologically messed up. Some of them have some very supernatural power. And I've dealt with them eyeball to eyeball, face to face, and it's the most frightening thing I've ever seen in my life. The parapsychological time bomb. It's out there. It's very weird. And we end up presenting it to our kids more like, hey, it's just a funny thing. I mean, they call it and all that. It's just funny. It's not funny. And it's not harmless. The third area in the spiritual time bomb is the religious time bomb. Religion has been basically set up as a system of do's and don'ts trying to reach God. And it's basically been set up as almost like a Phariseeism type of thing where if you can keep the do's and the don'ts, then you can make it. You'll be all right. As I was growing up, as I've told some of you before, I saw some things that I couldn't do, and there were a lot of things I couldn't do. That's how you got your ticket, what you couldn't do. Then you go around and you say, I don't do more than you don't do. You know, I mean, that's your identity in life. And then you ask, you say, what can you do? And you kind of smile, hoping they smile too. And they give you three or four things you can do. You can go to church on Sunday morning, you can go to church on Sunday night, you can go to church on Wednesday night. By the way, there's a meeting over here on Thursday morning you've just got to be to, because that one, I mean, you get you more of a front seat when you get there. And besides, it'll help you get your ticket. And I mean, all this kind of thing, do's and don'ts, do's and don'ts. And as I looked at those two lists, I saw all those things I couldn't do, and those are what I wanted to do in life. And saw the things I had to do, and that's what I didn't want to do in life. Then I was in a mess. Then I went to another group. Another group said, look, you let us dunk you in your tank, our tank over here, or sprinkle you, or dry clean you, or drown you, or something, then you'll come out all right. I got fed up to here with nausea over religion. It really bugs me a bunch. I mean, a bunch. Man can't get to God on his own. That's just not the way it works. Then they started moving into some very interesting terms in the last 10, 15, almost 20 years in religion, and that is that they teach you how to leap into the dark. And they teach you that that's what faith's all about. Not true. Not true. You want to go leap in the dark, that's your business. But I'm not big on leaping in the dark. I'm not big on being in the dark, as a matter of fact. But it's just a leap into nothing. Look, shut your mind off and believe this. That's the answer. And that's why many people have been completely turned off, just as I've been turned off. Turned off. Don't like it. Don't want any more of it. It stinks. And offering us nothing. Not of reality. And so people are holding on to a smoke ring up here in a religious time bomb that when a tragedy comes along, he tries to grab for the smoke ring and nothing's there. A false hope is worse than no hope at all. Then there's the social time bombs. These are interesting. There's the political time bomb. Of course, with all the corruption coming along, you wonder what's going to happen next. But the political time bomb is going off to where we don't know who we can trust. We didn't trust them anyway, and then they go corrupt on us and prove that they were bad. And now we're in a mess. You see? We thought they were in control. I mean, as in control as anybody can be, and now they're out of control. The next time bomb is the technological time bomb. Technological time bomb. The technological time bomb is a very interesting one because what's happened is in the technological age, we have moved people more toward a computerized society, toward being machine-like in the first place. We move them in here, and you sit down, and you sit at this table, and you do this kind of assembly line work, and you move out, you wear the same kind of clothes, you wear, and it's just in and out, in and out. The guy goes to work, he puts in his time, comes home, and that's it. In and out. And it becomes machine-like in the process. Then there's the economic time bomb. Of course, that's been precipitated more and more by the Arab oil situation. It's interesting that in the Old Testament, in Zechariah, I believe it is, it foretold through one of the Jewish prophets that in one day that the economic center of the world would be placed in the Middle East and would be placed in the Arab countries in the Middle East. It's an interesting little prophecy. And I never could figure that out until finally it happened. Then it dawned on me, not bad at all, oil. does a lot for my insecurity to realize that they're in control of what's happening economically. And that brings about a fear, because we wonder from time to time, although we're kind of fattening up right now and really think everything's fine, we wonder how far it's going to go. At least 85% of you here are in real estate, and you know that we're living in some unreal times. How far can it go? We're fearful. We're not sure exactly what's going on. The next time bomb is the sociological time bomb. The sociological time bomb is basically the disintegration of the family unit. It's the most devastating thing that's ever happened in our society. And every time this family unit is disintegrated in a civilization, the civilization falls. The next time bomb is the educational time bomb. The educational time bomb is going through a very interesting crisis right now in education. All the educational journals are screaming out, we've got to give them values. It hasn't worked just to give them reading, writing, arithmetic, and then everything's fine, because we've got to give them values. We've got to give them morality. We've got to give them an ethic. And yet, who's going to pick out the ethic? Who's going to say what's right and who's going to say what's wrong? We're in a heap of trouble. So we continue to use the dump truck method and give them everything we can, run them through, get the herd through, and give them their diploma, and now we're on. The educational time bomb. I spoke to a group of principals in the state of Ohio from all over the state. And I basically talked about the educational time bomb and asked an awful lot of questions and started to pose some answers. But they heard it loud and clear because they're living there. And it's fearful. The next one is the instant breakfast time bomb. It's the new and the now. We got to have it now. Day before yesterday. It's instant coffee, instant breakfast, instant everything-ism. And if we don't get it, we get mad. I mean angry. Foaming at the mouth type angry. Instant, 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 instant. If that doesn't work, we throw it away. We get another one. It's the throwaway society. The instant breakfast approach. All of these time bombs, and we could list many more, all of these time bombs are sitting on top of two other time bombs that are even worse off than these. These two others are as follows. The first is the ethical time bomb. We really don't have a whole lot of ethics today. I mean, we don't have a standard of right and wrong. We're in a heap of trouble. And nobody knows where to go to get it. That's what's even more devastating. You know, in our country, as a matter of fact, most of the world has been living on one ethic. It's very interesting. They've been living on, and we've been living on, the Judeo-Christian ethic. But in the last few years, we've had the rug pulled out from under us saying, now, wait a minute. I mean, God probably went away and took a trip or something, and he's not there anymore. And so we pull the rug out, and then we're wondering why we don't have any answers to back up this ethic we've been talking about of loving one another. Why love one another? Who says we got to love one another? Who says I got to love you? Who says I got to get along with anybody? You see? And all of a sudden, this why is just screaming out and reverberating to the point where we don't have an answer. The way we handle ethics today is it starts out in three steps, very important steps. The first is, it all depends on how you look at it. It all depends on how you look at it. Boy, that's a heavy one. It all depends on how we look at it. They usually go like, it all depends. You have to get a pensive look. The second step, it doesn't make any difference how you look at it. I mean, it really doesn't. It doesn't make any difference how you look at it. Third step, I don't think anybody knows how to look at it. All of a sudden, we have a standard, a morality, an ethic, and we take it through that process, and we move into agnosticism to where nobody knows how to look at it, nobody's in control, no morality is there, no ethic, no standard, no value, no nothing. And so the answer is do your own thing. But don't you see, that doesn't work? Doing your own thing doesn't work? It can't be that way. We can't all do our own thing. I talked to a guy one time. I've talked to a lot of agnostic people, and I think agnostic people are really neat because they're searching, and that's really super. I don't want anybody to buy something until they've searched. And I really like talking to agnostic people. I talked to a person who said to me, one day, he said, I am an atheist. I said, well, that's very interesting. I haven't met a lot of atheists, and I'm interested to talk with you. I want to see how consistent you are. He said, great. So we started talking. We had a great time. The guy was Jewish. He was at American University, and I was working with the rabbi there quite a bit. And as we were talking, I said, what would happen if I pulled my Bic pen out and stabbed you? He said, man, you got to do your own thing. I mean, if there's nobody calling the shots out there, and there is nobody calling the shots, you got to do your own thing. He said, I wouldn't like it a whole lot, but you got to do your own thing. I said, okay, what if I stabbed you 5 times? He said, hey, it'd hurt me a little more, but you got to do your thing. He was as consistent as could be. We kept talking through, and I said, what if I just keep stabbing you until you're dead? He said, well, you got to do your thing. I mean, you know, we've all got to do our thing. If you feel like that's what you got to do, then you got to do your thing. I said, so if anybody wants to do anything, I mean, they got to do what their thing is, right? Right. So then Hitler was right when he killed the 6 million Jews. Is that correct? He went berserk. Absolutely berserk. He got mad. He stood up. I settled him down a minute. But you see, that's where it leads. There is no ethical way to look at that. There's no way to say that doing your own thing is the only way to go. All of that ethical time bomb, the crisis of values, morals, how are we going to get it together? How can we have an adequate base? That's built upon the philosophical time bomb. You know who are the most philosophical people in the world? You're not going to believe this. Not at first. Children. Little children are the most philosophical people in the world. They ask really heavy questions. Where do we come from? Why do people die? Where do people go when they die? They come back? Why do we live here? Why do you go to work? Why do we stay home when you go to work? Why do we go to school? Why do we need to love people? I mean, they are philosophical. You know what we do with them? We push those questions aside quickly because we don't want to answer them. I mean, those are difficult questions. But it's a philosophical problem we've got. And I'm not a philosopher, nor the son of a philosopher, but I do know enough to know that we are in a heap of trouble philosophically. We don't have a basis for right and wrong. We don't have a basis for the ethics. And because we don't have a basis for the ethics, we have no hope up here. No hope whatsoever. The only hope we've got is if we have an elite that tells us what to do and what not to do. But wait a minute. Who's going to tell them what's right and wrong? One biologist said that what we ought to do is we ought to put a pill, put some chemicals in the water so that we keep the society very calm. Drug all the society. Then nobody will be aggressive and nobody will shoot anybody and this kind of thing. What I want to know is who's going to put the chemical in the water? Who's going to say what the dose is? Who's going to say who's going to do it? Another one said we ought to give all these drugs to the world leaders. Then we can be safe. Can't you imagine what will happen then? Who's going to give them the drugs? An Arab? A Jew? A Chinaman? A Russian? An American? Maybe a Swiss? Who hands out the drugs? We are in a crisis that unless we solve it, we are in a heap of trouble. I think there's a way to solve it. I wouldn't be standing up here saying we're in a heap of trouble. I'm not a good doomsday guy. You know what I mean? I'm not good at that. The debris from the time bombs, are threefold. The debris are threefold. Number one, fear. These time bombs are causing so much fear. There's fear of the future. What in the world's going to happen? Can we solve these problems? Do you know what some scientists are saying at MIT? They are saying that we cannot exist past 2023. We can't exist. It's impossible because of all the problems we got. These guys aren't making money off saying things like that, okay? I don't like it when they say things like that. That makes me afraid. It's called fear of the future. You think your kids aren't getting that same kind of fear? You bet your life. Because they're gathering it from you. There's also fear of relationships. this University of Rhode Island study about the most violent setting in the country today is the home. That is a frightening deal. They said that over 1 million children are affected each year by a butcher knife or a gun by their parents. 1 million a year. Makes me afraid to go home. There's fear of identity. Who am I? Who am I? By the way, I mentioned something about evolution and creation, all this kind of stuff this morning, and I didn't back it up with some things. There are tons of books. There's a whole group of scientists, over 3,500 scientists, a lot of them internationally known, who have an organization that they do nothing but just deal with this subject of creation versus evolution. And interesting group. Well, there's one book by A.E. Wilder Smith. A.E. Wilder Smith. It's called Man's Origin, Man's Destiny. Man's Origin, Man's Destiny. It's a book that's worth your reading, and it's on a level where I think most everybody can understand it, because I don't like to read books that I don't understand, and I can read that one. So Man's Origin, Man's Destiny, A.E. Wilder Smith. It'll give you some good feeling of, he's an internationally known scientist and one of the first to come out and really shoot at the evolutionary process. What's happened in evolution is we've taught it so much that it's not a theory anymore, it's a fact, and now we've embraced it as a philosophy. It's a philosophy of life. We're nothing more than an animal, so who cares? What makes a difference? Man is absurd, but he must act desperately as if he's not. Fear. Fear. These time bombs cause fear. The second thing they cause is anger. You're seeing the cycle come, aren't you? Anger. Anger. One of the most pressing problems today is what I call the pressure cooker approach, that where people build up this pressure on the inside of them, they're angry, angry, angry people. Some of you have got a very pressure cooker approach right now in your own life. Some of you are living with people who have that same kind of pressure cooker approach. I'm going to describe it a little bit for you so you can begin to see it. We all are moving in that direction because the society is shooting at us, and these time bombs are going off all around us. But many times, as we grow up in a relationship with our parents, usually a bad relationship with a same-sex parent, is a very difficult start in life, because that's where we develop our conscience primarily, is with that same-sex parent. And if we don't have a good relationship with that same-sex parent, what happens many times is the pressure cooker effect starts. Or if we're in a relationship where our parents were always dominant, or else the opposite, just let us do everything, we weren't able to really find our boundaries, or we weren't able to express our feelings, so we always did what mother wanted or always did what dad wanted, but never really got it out. Then we build up anger and pressure. We keep our top on because that's how you got to cope in life. But what happens is the person cannot have a long-term relationship with anybody, an intimate, long-term relation where there's responsibility. May be great in business, but cannot commit himself or herself to a long-term relationship with anybody. That's why many, many homes are breaking up like crazy. And you could tell more stories than I could. Because many times the man cannot hang in on the responsibility of the wife. And what he says is this, most common thing you hear, I don't want to be married anymore. I don't want the responsibility of marriage. I don't want the responsibility of children. I don't want it. He's running. Why? Because he's living on his emotions. He's living on that anger. There's no logic to it. There is no reasoning, no logic whatsoever. It's a lack of impulse control. You flip from here to here to here to here. This one doesn't work. That one doesn't work. I've got to try this, try that, try this. They'll go from affair to affair. Never works. 85% of the people that get divorced to go marry somebody else never get married to somebody else. Why? Because it was a whipped cream relationship. It wasn't any reality there. And so they build up the anger. And they're just angry, angry people. Sometimes they blow their top and have a temper tantrum and really do some wild things. That's how some people go berserk and start shooting people. That's one thing. That's an extreme area. Other times, they just run. They run because they can't get too close to anybody, because if they do, they open up that top. And when they open up that top, then the garbage comes out, and they don't want anybody to see that. So they stay away from close relationships. A lot of times they won't have any close friends at all. None at all. Nobody they can really talk to. It's a desperate thing. And we're making it happen with our parent-child relationships. We're causing it in our society. Now, you can get a good dose of it even though you're doing everything right in the parent-child relationship. You can still get a good dose of it from out there in the society because of all the pressure. But it's a real sense of irresponsibility, no conscience, no conscience developed. Anger. It's desperate. Very desperate. What has to happen, as a matter of fact, many counselors will not even deal with this. They will not even deal with it. And it may be 85% of the problem, of most people's problem. They won't deal with it because these people can it's very difficult for you to work through the problem. I am so fortunate, and this is not a commercial, this is free, but I'm so fortunate I've got a counselor in our center who just turns people around in this area. I've never seen anything like it in my life. I mean, he just turns the thing around. His name's Dr. Vanian. The guy is incredible. He diffuses the anger. And it gets worse before it gets better because all the garbage is coming out, and it gets kind of bad for a while. And then, as he diffuses it, they move back into a logical base of operation. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. Fear. And that fear, because of all the fears out there, we get angry that we can't control all these time bombs out there. We just get angry about it. I mean, I just get ticked off about that crazy political scene over there. And just it's driving me crazy over there in Uganda. The guy, I could go berserk over him. All kinds of things to get angry about. Third, guilt. Guilt. There's a psychological makeup within every person that says that I've got to pay when I do something wrong. I've got to pay for what I do wrong, or I've got to pay for what I didn't do right. It's guilt down there. Sometimes there's false guilt, but don't ever, ever think that you can get rid of true guilt by just saying it's not there. Because it is there. There's a system on the inside that says, I've got to pay for everything I do wrong. So when you get depressed sometimes, you're depressed because you feel guilty. You're shooting at yourself. You're cutting yourself down. And so you're trying to pay for your guilt. Many people kill themselves trying to make the ultimate payment for guilt. And the reason why they kill themselves is because maybe they did something wrong or their life isn't worth anything. And so they shoot themselves. They think that's the ultimate payment. That's hardly a payment. Guilt. Fear, anger, and guilt. And the guilt then proves that I don't know how to live life, and it's more fear again. Fear, anger, guilt. Fear, anger, guilt. All the way through. It's incredible. I just talked with a person not long ago who's scared to death that he's going to end up like his father in a wheelchair with the same kind of disease. Scared to death. And ever since he had that fear, starting at around 18 or 19 years old, he is going like crazy, running to and fro, and he's so angry that that's probably what's going to happen to him. Then he blurts out against his wife and his kids and everything else, comes right back and feels guilty about it. That makes him for sure he's not doing so well, and fear, anger, guilt, all the way through. It's incredible. We've talked about the detonation of time bombs, the debris from the time bombs, and all that's been kind of yucky. Let's move into the third area. How do we diffuse the time bomb? Diffusion of the time bombs. In these three points that I'm going to give now, this is how you develop a conscience. This is how you develop maturity. If you want more on this, the Maximum Manhood series does talk about a lot of this, on how to have a basis for some of this, okay? Ideally, 0 to 6 would be this first step, faith. In developing maturity and conscience, the first step of faith is 0 to 6. Now let me explain what faith is. This is counteracting the fear. I'm talking about faith as the word means conviction. Conviction. Confidence. A basis of right and wrong. A basis for meaning. A basis for meaning. A basis for right and wrong. It's got to be there. Most psychologists and psychiatrists in grappling with this will use this in a very key way, that we've got to teach people a basis of right and wrong, a basis of authority. There's another way that many of them use it. A basis of right and wrong. Now, this is not talking about faith in faith. There's some people that talk about faith in faith. Faith in faith doesn't mean a whole lot. Hope you understand that. If you've got faith in your faith, you're in a heap of trouble. I mean, that's a vicious cycle. The object of your faith is the most important thing, and faith in faith is not the issue. And I'm not talking about leaping in the dark. I'm not talking about religious system. Oh, my. Not at all. Not at all. But I'm talking about a basis of right and wrong. In the Judeo-Christian ethic, well, let me back up. There are two systems, or two basic philosophies today. One is naturalism,
this is going to be a little philosophical, so put your hat on. Naturalism. Naturalism says that our whole universe has operated just as it always has and will continue to operate that way, and everything that exists exists inside this natural system. It's a closed system. Nothing can intervene. And what they say then is there is no supernatural out here. There is no God out here because there can't be any God. There are no miracles because there can't be any miracles. It's just kind of a vicious cycle. It's interesting. But basically, it's a closed system. And very closed-minded, I point out to people. Okay? The second system is an open system, and this would be the supernaturalist. Supernaturalism. And this says that there's an open system, uniformity of cause and effect in an open system. Everything has happened as it always has, yes, but there's an open system where if there is a supernatural force or personal being out there, that he could intervene. He could intervene. Okay? This seems to me like the most liberal approach to both sides. Liberal meaning open-minded. Most liberals are closed-minded. But liberal meaning open-minded. All right? The most general way to look at it. This seems to be like the most logical way to look at it. This is the way I approach life, the supernaturalist point. That doesn't mean that I'm walking on water or I shake hands with a cloud or anything like that. I mean, my hair doesn't fall out. My hair does fall out, but not because of that. But I don't have any wings or anything. That's not saying that. It's saying this is my base of operation. And from this base, I'm looking for the fact of whether there's a God out there or not. And if there is a God out there that's outside this system that can call the shots, then we have an adequate base for right and wrong. If all we've got is a naturalistic system, then we become machine-like, animal-like, or even plant-like. We're no better than we're just a higher animal. And when you start reasoning on that base and that system, you close the whole thing out. There is no God because there can't be any God. It's like Einstein said, who was not a small man in mind. He was kind of small, I guess, as he stood up, but in mind. Einstein asked his very brilliant students, he said, what percentage of the knowledge in all the universe do you suppose you have? They said, well, maybe 2%. Einstein thought that was a little high, but he allowed them to have 2% of all the knowledge of the universe. He said, what are the possibilities or the probabilities that God might exist in the other 98%? Pretty good. All I'm saying is we must be open to the fact that maybe he's out there, and if he is out there, he's the one that can call the shots. He's the one that can give a basis for right and wrong if there is a God. If there's not a God, well, it doesn't make a difference. You've got an open system, closed system, doesn't make a difference. But the open system says we're at least open to looking. Okay? We've got to have a basis of right and wrong. I'm saying that this basis right here, the supernaturalistic basis, the open-minded basis that says we're in an open system and God could intervene if he's out there, and may have already intervened if he's out there, and he hadn't gone away on vacation, that type of thing, not asleep, that is the best system for looking for a standard. Personally, I have accepted the standard that the Bible is a standard, not the way it's been taught in most circles, not at all. Not the way it's been pushed and done, and many atrocities done in the name of Christianity, not at all. Not as a religious system, but as a basis for right and wrong, and a basis that gives a game plan for life and says it's not a religion, but it's a relationship with God. Now that I'm high on. I mean, I'm big on that. I tell that to everybody. Nobody gets upset either. It's kind of neat. Because I'm down on religion too. But I do think there's a validity to look in to see, is the Bible really true or is it not? In Maximum Manhood, that's what I deal with. Is it true or is it not? I'm going to tell you someplace else I deal with it too. The second stage, so this first is a basis of right and wrong. We've got to have a basis. It would take me 6 hours to lay out the basis for you. I don't have time to lay out the basis. I just told you where I found it, okay? Read a good book on it. Next. B, love. This counteracts anger. This counteracts anger. Usually from 7 to 13, this kind of thing ought to be taught a child, and that is that your child needs to love and be loved. Your child needs a healthy context of relationships. Remember, there were two ingredients that I said that were good for self-image? Love, be lovable, and worthwhile. This is the lovable one. I added another one, basis for meaning, basis for right and wrong, this whole crisis of ethical crisis. It's not on a performance basis. They don't get love if they do this or do that. It's not like, mommy will love you if you go wash your hands. It's not that. It's I love you. Now go wash your hands. Very different. Very different. It's love with a commitment. It's love. It's a word that was coined by the New Testament writers, as a matter of fact, agape. Agape was coined. It's love with a commitment. I love you no matter what you do, no matter what you say. I love you. I love you. Now, there are other kinds of love out there. One kind of love, it would be the Greek word phileo, which means I like you. I like you because you do something for me. Nothing wrong with that, but that's hardly something to build a big relationship on. I like you because you do something to me. You quit doing something for me, then I don't like you anymore. Uh-huh. That's called performance. There's another one, eros. It wasn't even used in the Bible because it's such a gross word. And the word eros basically says, I love you because I love me. I love you because I love me. I mean, I really love you because I love me and because you can do something for me. And that's pretty bad news. It's basically where we get the word erotic and the idea in a bad sense of erotic and how you're just out to get what you can get, period. What we've got to teach our children is love means to have a commitment. Love means to have a commitment because that's very rare today. Love has a commitment to it. Okay? And again, back in 1 Corinthians 13, beautiful set of poetry there on what love is and what love is not. Very interesting. High standard, very good to teach yourself and your own kids. I meditate on that quite a bit, and it really helps my brain, and that's important for my brain. Okay, the elements of relationship, you've got to throw that in here as well. Okay, love counteracting anger. So we've got to have a healthy context of relationships. That helps the conscience. That helps the maturity. We've got a basis for right and wrong, basis for meaning, counteracting the fear. That helps the maturity process. Hope is the third. This counteracts the guilt. This counteracts the guilt. And this would come ideally in the teenage years. Because here is giving your child a sense of destiny, a sense of worthwhileness that we talked about earlier. A sense of worthwhileness. That they've got an identity, they've got a future, they've got some hope. So hope is built on the first two. Hope is built on the first two. You see, if man is a machine, there's no hope. If man is an animal, there's no hope. If man as he is right now is normal, and as sick as he is, then he's probably not going to get any better. But if man is abnormal, in other words, if man used to be something better than he is now, and that man, maybe there's hope he can get back to something he could be, or he used to be. And that's exactly what the Judeo-Christian ethic says. After man was created, man did something kind of weird. He rebelled. It's called wickedness. He rebelled. He said, God, you go your way, I'll go mine. Check with me when I'm 72, 73, we'll negotiate. It's called rebellion. Interesting little concept. And it says, I'll go my way, you go mine, you go yours. Hang it up, God. See you later. But man was created perfect until he did that. When he did that, he started exercising all kinds of wonderful things that have caused some problems for us ever since. And the only way, according to this supernaturalist system and the game plan I've been presenting to you all day, the only way to get back where there's hope is to come into a relationship with God. Again, I'm not talking about religion. I'm not talking about joining a church or a club or anything like that, or giving to the local lodge. I'm talking about a relationship with God. You see, many times we have used the payment idea, or we've used the non-payment idea to get rid of guilt. We've said to people in counseling, I haven't, counselors in general have said this, there are three ways to get rid of your guilt. One is, blame it on somebody else. Isn't that neat? I mean, that's a biggie. Blame it on somebody else, transfer it. I mean, she was a real witch anyway. I mean, she's good and nice. She's really, and blame it on her. Or society. Blame it on society. I mean, if anybody comes out healthy in this society, they ought to get a medal. Right, blame it on your mother. Oh, good night. I mean, she formulated your whole attitude and temperament and everything. I mean, blame it on her. Blame it on your dad. Or I like these commercials that come on. Just love them. I'd like to clip my television right then when I see these. They'll say, don't leave your keys in the car or you'll make a good boy go bad. Now, wait a minute. I'm feeling guilty all of a sudden now. I mean, I don't want to leave my keys in the car, but I'm not going to make a good boy go bad if I leave my keys in the car. That good boy was already bad and went badder. That's all. We want to get rid of the responsibility, so we blame somebody else. The second method to get rid of guilt, that doesn't get rid of guilt, but we keep telling people it does, is to move. Run. Run. I told one guy this. He said, well, where? I said, how about Central Africa? He said, why is that? I said, you don't know anybody there, do you? He said, no. I said, that's why it'd work. Because if you don't know anybody, then you don't feel guilty. All those standards out there, I mean, that's why you feel guilty probably. But it isn't. It doesn't work. You know what he told me? He said, I went to Seattle for 3 days, just hid in the hotel room, felt bad as I could. Just really bad. I mean, really bad. That didn't help. Third thing is, lower the standard. Get rid of the standard. I mean, if it bothers you, get rid of it. If you feel guilty because you're shacking up with somebody else, well, just say, hey, who's making up the rules anyway? Get rid of the standard. That'll help a bunch. Not really won't, but it will temporarily. You see, we've got to pay for the guilt. And again, I would push you toward realizing that the Judeo-Christian ethic, this whole game plan, must have to handle the fear, the anger, and the guilt in order to give the hope that's there, the faith, the love, and the hope. In order to have that, you've got to have an adequate base. In order to do that, you've got to come into a relationship with God. That's the whole bit of Christianity. Jesus Christ came to make a payment. That's it. Right there. I mean, it talks a little more about stuff than that. But he made a payment, so I don't need to feel guilty anymore if I just accept it. I think it's kind of neat, because I don't feel guilty anymore. I mean, I really don't. I refuse that kind of garbage. Because he's already paid for it. Strange as it may seem, he paid for it. But he can only pay for it if he was who he said he was, the God-man. Over and over and over again, he claimed to be the God-man. He said, if you've seen me, you've seen God. If you've heard me, you've heard God. If you touch me, you touch God. I'm trying to get a point across. He was claiming to be the God-man. We come along and say, wait a minute, he didn't really mean that. I mean, he meant something deeper. He didn't mean anything deeper. He meant he was the God-man, that's all. It's almost like it would be a chart like this. This is free, I wasn't going to do this. But here's a chart. And let's say that he makes this statement, I am the God-man, and it's either true or it's false. Uh-huh, true. Or truer, is what that was. True or false? If it's true, who was he, basically? Roughly, the God-man, yes. If we didn't make that one, we're not going to make the next one, I'll tell you. This is really heavy over here. If it's false, there are two alternatives. Forget that thing right there. He either knew it was false, that he really wasn't the God-man, but he's running around saying, I am. Or he did not know it was false. He's running around saying, I'm the God-man. He really wasn't the God-man, but he thought he was. Now, if he knew it was false, what was he? A liar. Yeah. He was a liar. If he didn't know it was false and run around saying, I'm God, who was he? Nuts. Right. You know what most people do with this? I just can't get over the intellectual integrity of people. Most people handle this way. I mean, really, they handle it this way because they've been taught to handle it this way. And after they've seen some of the garbage that's put out under the name of the religion, I don't blame them for handling it this way. But here's what they do. Outstanding guy. Great teacher. Could have made who's who of Jerusalem if he'd stuck around long enough. Too bad he died. Doesn't work that way. We got either one of three alternatives. He either was the God-man, or he was nuts, badly hallucinated or nuts, or he was a liar. I've often said it's like I walk into a room and say, hey, my name's not Tim Timmons at all. I'm a poached egg. And you sit there and say, could be, man. I've never seen anything quite this weird before. And paid for it, too. That's what I can't get. You've got three alternatives. I'm either a liar trying to get attention, but this is a heavy one here, badly hallucinated or nuts, or I really am indeed the first poached egg you've ever seen walk the talk. But I guarantee you one thing, after sitting here and listening to me for 6 hours telling you I'm a poached egg, nobody is going to walk out of here and say, you know, even though he says he's a poached egg, he's all right. You don't do that to people like that. You put them behind lock and key and you never let them out, ever. That's the same kind of thing I'm talking about. Not religion. Oh, that stinks. But it's a relationship. You ought to investigate it. Might even change your life. I mean, we wouldn't want to have it change too much, of course, but just a little bit. Because it really gets down to the gut level of putting a basis for right and wrong, and then a basis for my healthy context of relationships and that love for one another, and then a basis for hope in getting rid of the guilt. I've never seen anything else work. Nothing. And yet every time people try this, it works. Not religion, not joining anything, not paying your dues, nothing like that. A relationship. It's incredible. priority of relationships. When you leave, here's what you ought to do. Now, most parents, when they leave, they'll pick up on something like discipline, and they move in with a new regime. I told you about that before, didn't I? Don't start a new regime. Don't say, hey, kids, we learned something today. Don't do that. You'll start fear, anger, and guilt tonight in them. When you leave, the first thing you do, start here, relationships. Evaluate that relationship that you've got with your children and move in there and relate. Start here. Number two, don't be quick to start a new regime. Three, you can't do anything effectively without doing this first. You've got to start with a relationship. You must start here. Don't start anywhere else. Start here. That's why I keep talking about it all day long. I hope you're getting the point. You've got to have a relationship with your child or nothing else works. Nothing else works. The priorities within relationships. There are five priorities I've listed out here, and I'd like to talk through them briefly and just kind of give you an idea of how to put everything together now that we've talked about. Because if your priorities are out of whack, then you really can't put a lot of this stuff to practice. The first priority is God consciousness. A God consciousness. Coming from this biblical game plan, what I'm talking about here, what I'm saying is, number one priority is to get that straightened out. If you're searching, keep searching. If you're skeptical, then begin to find some answers to your own questions. But wherever you are, seek to put that God consciousness where it needs to be. I suggest that you move into looking into a relationship with God. Because I've seen it work, and I believe that's what the only true base for morality and ethics and values can be. Okay. The second is your mate. You want to do your child a favor? Fall in love with your mate. You want to do your child a big favor? Fall in love with your mate. Notice, men, that your business is not number two. You notice that? Isn't that something? I mean, it's not there. Your mate. Notice, women, your house isn't number two. Or your children. They're not number two. You've got to fall in love with your mate. You've got to cultivate that relationship. You've got to be a student of your wife. You men. You've got to know what makes her tick and ticked. Very important. You got to come to the Maximum Marriage Seminar and you'll find more of that out, right? Right. I didn't hear anybody say right. You women, you've got to find out how to get on that husband's team. Two people cultivating a relationship, getting on each other's team, and focusing on one another, that's dynamite. Because it's so weird. It really stands out. And it'll do wonders for your kids. Three, C, child. Your relationship with your child. So we've got God consciousness, your mate, your children. Number three. Now, priorities really take a beating sometimes. You know, when you got hot coffee and you're serving it in the living room, you got guests over, and your husband spills the coffee. It hit his leg, but it also hit the chair. Wife runs into the living room. My chair! That chair never did live, so it's not going to die. He's got third-degree burns on the right knee, and she's worried about the chair. Priorities really take a beating there. Four, your vocation. Your vocation. I still can't get over the fact that people pay me to do what I do. Because I have so much fun speaking. The corporations are now paying me to come in and just talk about priorities and how to get the executive in his proper priorities in his home so that he can be more productive at work, because every study proves it. Every study proves it. If he doesn't have his act together at home with his wife and his children, he isn't going to perform well over there long term. Not long term. Matter of fact, the stress documentary the other night said that not only will they not perform long term, it's not a matter of whether you choose whether you're going to spend time here or spend time there. It's a matter of if you're going to live or not. That's the issue. As one guy put it, he said, I found out that I had to put my priorities back together, because if I didn't, I wouldn't be around to watch my kid in junior high. That's a reality. The fifth is the social. Having good, healthy social involvement. Now, priorities are not talking about quantity of time. but quality of time. Not quantity of time, but quality of time. I find when I can handle my priorities, and by the way, you don't just write them down and now you got them. I mean, now that you've got the insight and this vast bit of knowledge, you don't have it now. You got to go fight it now. I got to fight it tomorrow morning when I get up. I may start even tonight, but I've got to fight it, you see. You got to fight these priorities all the time. And I find when I'm really at it on this priority business that I'm a stronger person in my productivity and my vocation and a much more interesting person in social circles because I can handle the stronger points, the higher points. The higher the priority, the more important it is. You know what we end up doing, though? We hire live-ins and bring them in to free us up from the higher priorities so we can go do some other things. Isn't that interesting? We didn't win there for some reason. That's not the idea. If you're going to get somebody to help you, have them help you do something on a lower priority so you can have more time to get involved in what's really meaningful. The magic word, and those of you who have been to Maximum Marriage know the magic word, tough word, no. Would you say it with me, please?
No.
Oh, once again, no. Isn't that neat? Hardest word to say in the world, no. A lot of you, when you say it, you feel guilty. And others of you feel guilty because you wish you had, didn't know how to say it. It's easy. You just say, no. 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 No, I can't. No, we'd love to, but no. No. When I travel quite a bit, on Mondays, my day off happens to fall right then. And on my day off, I'm out of work. I don't work on Mondays when I'm traveling. When I'm doing a seminar schedule on Saturday, I don't work on Mondays. Somebody calls and says, look, I'm going to kill myself. I'd like to check with you before I do. I say, fine, could you wait till tomorrow? I don't work on Mondays. Very important to me that I don't work on Mondays. It's very important to my wife that I don't work on Mondays. It's very important that I have that kind of focus time with my family. Then I'm convinced I'm going to live a little longer. I keep wonderful calendars, and I used to doodle on my calendar on my day off time. I put day off. I'd underline it. I'd put exclamation points, and I mean, it was beautiful. Never took it. But it was on my calendar. I mean, anybody could see it. But never took it. I'd pick up the mail. That's devastating. Get on another project, write another book, anything. I mean, just picking up the letter that you get in the mail. Answer the phone, that's not a good thing either. You can stick that in the bean bag, do something. But get away from it all and say no. No. I remember one time a few years ago when I was basically doing seminars by primarily sponsored by churches and this sort of thing, a guy called me up and he said, I've got God has told me. That's what he said. God has told me. When they say it like that, it scares me. God has told me. Well, what did he tell you? That you're going to be our speaker this spring. Oh, really? And what I'm wondering is, why didn't you check with me, you see? I mean, just at least let me know. He didn't have to ask. He could just tell me. So I said, well, when is it going to be? I don't have any open weekends. He said, oh, I found out yesterday from your secretary. It is Easter. And that's our time. We're going to have you there Easter. That's the way. Oh, hold it. That's not open. That's not open? What do you mean it's not open? Aren't you ministering on Easter? I said, no, I'm out of the ministry on Easter. You're what? I said, I'm out of the ministry on Easter. I mean, I'm just not a man of the cloth on that day. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to be with my family over in this little recreation area. The guy got so angry, hung up. He couldn't handle the no. But I love to say no. I mean, I get thrills out of saying no. You want a maximum lifestyle? You got to get your act together and your priorities and learn how to say no at the proper time. Maximum parenthood. Just two people coming together. One gets larger than the other. Don't want to hurt anybody. Then we have children, and they don't want to hurt anybody, and then all of a sudden we're hurting each other. Doesn't have to be if you can find a strategy that works.